tell me what you want, lady. Yes, you wanna check the pills, man, put up notes. Come on, let's get right for the Sunday. 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 Come on.
I guess that's a pretty good way to intro into a podcast about summer blockbusters.
Yeah, and a couple of cool kids.
Ah, that's so good, because that song was Get Right by the Cool Kids.
Yeah, a couple of cool kids that are roughly 140 years old.
Yeah, which, that's because I'm Amadeo Modigliani.
And I am Mortimer Granville.
Painter and vibrator maker.
Yep, vibrator enthusiast, I like to call myself.
That's good, it sounds a little bit more noble.
Yeah, a little, it looks better on a business card.
Vibrator enthusiast. Do you just, what size font do you put that?
Size 28 Comic Sans.
Ah, nice. I thought you'd put Wingding or Wing Dong. That's okay. So this is
Yeah.
This is the Filmed Weekly Viewing Diary. We talk about movies in an analytical and scholarly kind of way that helps you learn more about them and make them better.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're exploring some film. We sponsor Ray Langford, the best center fielder the St. Louis Cardinals ever had. Go to baseballreference.com and check out Ray Langford.
And just be in awe of his stats.
Yeah, dude, put up some numbers.
He took out a dude at home plate once.
Darren Dalton. Was it Dalton?
Yeah, he got his shit racked.
Yeah. Now, Langford's about as cool as any of the hobbits that destroyed that ring. I like to think. Our sponsors, for reasons we don't understand, we don't have any. Just not obvious to us.
We're a couple of white boys who love hip-hop, talk about Ray Langford every show.
And, but we do great stuff with movies, so...
Make dick jokes.
We make so many dick jokes. I never, I started to keep track, finally. And
actually, Oh, what's that?
I kept track of how many dick jokes we made, and...
Oh, yeah?
Let's just say, it's above average.
Yeah, I was thinking that if we wanted to get more sponsors, we could maybe lay off the dick jokes just like a little bit and maybe focus on masturbation jokes a little more. Just a thought. So, I thought maybe we could brainstorm later. I don't know why I'm bringing it up now. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, we can. But if anybody has any products dealing with masturbation, we're the show for you.
Unfortunately, yes.
Or movies.
That's no longer a joke.
If you deal with movies, we can sponsor you too. Or you can sponsor us.
If you made a movie about masturbation,
that's even better.
Well, that new Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie is about a guy addicted to porn.
Yeah, so if Joseph Gordon-Levitt wants to sponsor us, here we are.
Yep. Let's do this.
Here we are.
By okay. Do this, I mean do Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, yeah. At the same time? No, okay, so our show today is about Pacific Rim. The new Giants movie involving giant things. It's not a penis joke.
No.
Or is it?
Well.
Well, okay. So, Pacific Rim, and we have a sub-discussion on centerpiece moments in a film. What does the centerpiece reveal, and what does it point towards? And where will we go from there? Do you want to define what a centerpiece is?
It's not obvious enough, no. Well, we didn't really know if there was a term for it already, so we're kind of just going with this. But basically, it's a portion of the movie that's distinct in style or tone or point in time that's different from most of the movie. And it's built up to by the preceding plot and is meant to shift, is followed by a shift in any form. It can signify a power dynamic, a character relationship, just a general shift in narrative, basically.
Yep. Or you could even say style, like the tornado could be the centerpiece of Wizard of Oz.
Sure.
And everything turns colorful. Whee! Yay! Okay.
So yeah, section one is I Have a Brother.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is, unfortunately.
Yeah, we'll talk about four movies. Mort's going to talk about Lawrence Anyways and Rocky IV.
And Modig's going to talk about RoboCop and La Ventura.
Yes. Section two is I Had a Brother, which is where we talk about Pacific Rim.
Yep. Pacific Rim-related things. And then section three is Everyone I Love Dies.
Yeah.
And that's, we have questions, recommendations, our list off. Do we say what the list off is going to be?
Yeah, let's tell
them. It's going to be best book adaptations.
Best book adaptations.
You can think of your own favorite book adaptations throughout the podcast and see if we match any of yours. And then the award is going to be best original screenplay. And then we're going to just talk about dumb shit we did over the weekend at the end.
Yeah, our lives, which is probably the best time to actually start listening.
Yeah. It's kind of like the credit sequence in a movie. If the movie's, like, shitty, like, if you go to see Grown Ups 2, the only thing that might be worth it is the bloopers.
Yeah.
So, although maybe not.
Maybe not.
That group actually is not producing the best bloopers.
I'd actually be pretty terrified. I feel like their bloopers would be angry and sad.
I feel like their bloopers are the movie, because it's basically them just sitting around talking.
So their movie is basically our podcast.
Oh, shit.
It really puts things into perspective. We should not talk.
yeah, okay. But we're pointing at Adam Sandler doing it anyway. So.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck it.
Yeah. All right. I Have a Brother. Talking about centerpiece moments in film. I guess I'll go first.
Yes, you will.
I'm going to do Lawrence Anyways. It's a new movie by Xavier Dolan. And I believe it's French. I don't know why I said that. I don't know if it's French. Look really quick. Well, let's see here. Oh, yeah, it's French. Okay, great. I wasn't sure if maybe it was Canadian or something. So basically this movie is about a transgender woman and her journey of becoming a woman and, you know, and she's trying to work through a relationship with her girlfriend the whole time, and they're trying to work through it and deal with that situation. The centerpiece moment of this film, if we're talking purely discussing breaks from like stylistic moments and tonal shifts, it actually occurs at the very beginning of the film. We have a tight shot closely following behind a transgender woman as she struts through the streets. There's shots of her hair, shots of her high heels, and she has this, like, supreme confidence. It may take place at the beginning of the film, but it both points at the past events the film will continue to cover throughout and what will become of our main character, Lawrence. As she walks by passerbys, they stare at her, and they offer an array of, like, confusion and contempt. And in short, nobody is simply apathetic towards her appearance. This is very much the theme behind the film. The simple act of staring signifies a position of privilege that, in fact, reduces Lawrence's problems to a purely physical level. For Lawrence, altering her appearance was an emotional inherent choice that she only recently realized. And earlier in the film, when Lawrence first dresses up as a woman, she walks down the hallway in silence of a school in silence, only the clicking of her heels and wary looks from students. And the film builds towards the supreme level of confidence put on display in those opening moments when there's, like, rock music going and she's fully confident in herself. And her clothing's much more extravagant and her hair's, you know, wilder. And it becomes a signifier that Lawrence must transcend the sense of entitlement associated with these onlookers. Her situation is not something to be contained and studied and dissected. It is simply her, so this moment is allowed to point towards progression as she continues to grow as a woman and rise above the stares that she will receive throughout the film.
What do you think it does for a movie to put a centerpiece then near the very beginning?
Well, it lets you know right away where the character will end.
Mm.
because right after that it says 10 years earlier, and I don't think there's any notion that you're going to get the what we saw at the beginning in the middle of the film.
Right.
It's very much like this is the height. Like there's like rock music going. She's like really confident, and it just seems like that if you put in the viewer's mind that that's what you're building towards, then it doesn't mean that it can only go up. It can go up and down throughout the movie, but we know that it's going to end, I guess, on a more optimistic note.
Yeah, it's almost like having the narrator speaking in a murder mystery or something, or a horror film, sure. Where you know that person's going to survive.
Yeah, maybe something like have you ever seen Rope?
No, I haven't.
Rope starts with a murder. It starts with them murdering a guy and then putting him in a dresser, and then the movie goes on from there, and it all takes place in one room, but everybody having dinner over this dresser. And I can kind of see it in that sense, where you can almost predict at that point that they're going to find the body eventually.
Right.
But that's not the, you know, that's not all that matters. Everything that leads up to it is what's going to create the tension.
Yeah, there's even tension then in knowing where you're going to get to. Like, how are we going to get there? It's like knowing that you're going to drive from, say, a merciless hellhole like Cleveland to... No, I love Cleveland. But, like, Cleveland to Chicago, and you know that they end up in Chicago, but you don't know what's going to happen along the way, or what's going to happen to you along the way.
Yeah, and even if the film does end on a positive note, such a high note, it probably signifies more than anything that things are going to be shitty a lot. It's not going to start out great. There's going to be extreme dilemma. I mean, anybody who can, relate to that situation or even know somebody that's transgender probably knows that that's not an easy decision, so.
Yep. Yeah, it's not. Life's hard.
Get a helmet. Why did
we do
that? Okay. All right, RoboCop.
Okay, RoboCop. 1987 film by Paul, I don't know how to say his name, Verhoeven?
Yeah.
That seems right, okay. And it stars Peter Weller as the titular RoboCop. If it's a movie set in Detroit, you know it's going to involve violence. Sorry, Detroits. In this case, it's classic cops versus robbers and drug dealers and corrupt politicians. Murphy is sort of the up-and-coming, hotshot new cop, and it's his first day, and he's murdered by drug dealers. And not just murdered, they blow him apart with shotguns. It's an ugly scene. But he's reanimated by the Omni Consumer Products, that corporation, as RoboCop, the first cyborg police officer. What we see throughout most of the movie is a cycle of police work and criminal activity leading to a showdown between the cops and the bad guys. So you'll see the bad guy doing something, RoboCop doing something, and then they collide in a short scene. And then this continues on, escalating until we get the final showdown. Lots of people die. There's a lot of violence. And throughout all of this, RoboCop is struggling with the haunting presence of his human identity. When he's being constructed, he sees flashbacks, memories of his wife and kid. They're half-remembered. He doesn't quite get to fully experience them. So the centerpiece of the film, for me, is the moment between all the violent actions and the police work and the drug people when RoboCop looks up the information on Murphy, which is himself, and goes to his old home. The home's in a weird state. It's between being shown for sale and total abandonment. It's like someone tried to sell it and couldn't, and there's sheets on furniture, still the for sale information, but you can tell it just hasn't worked. During the scene, Robo Murphy remembers what the house once looked like. He fully recalls his son and his wife, and he's seeing the life that he lost, everything that he had. The scene ends with him punching through a TV screen. He's no longer the cyborg that was programmed to stop crime. In this moment, we understand he's a man made into a cyborg who wants revenge. He's regained part of himself that was lost. He can't regain all of it, but he's more human than what he was. And this moment, this return to the house, gives the movie its heart. Mm-hmm. If you don't have this scene, the movie loses a very crucial dimension.
Yeah, and it also is sort of a centerpiece for the themes at hand, like the idea of corporations running everything and technology taking over, and showing that the humanity behind those things always transcends that idea.
Right, and we're seeing then, too, how it strips people of their humanity and the private life that they had. His private life's ruined. It's gone.
Yeah, that's what's great about Verhoeven, is he takes it to the extreme. RoboCop has literally been stripped of everything to the point where his body has been reconstructed.
That's true. Yep. He's a metaphor.
Mm. Yep.
But
that's
it also,
all Verhoeven knows.
It also points towards maybe by trying to regain part of our human aspects or let our humanity drive us, that we're able to somehow reclaim part of who we were. Mm-hmm. Which is what happens.
What a softie.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about Rocky IV.
Do it.
I was looking at movies I had watched recently, and I kind of just went over Rocky IV because why talk about that movie? But I'm realizing that it's kind of perfect because it features, of course, the greatest montage of all time, which is Rocky training in the cold, bleak Russian landscape with John Cafferty's Hearts on Fire looping for nine goddamn minutes. And the more I thought about it, I realized that it's a very bold choice to make to have a 9-minute montage. And it's a significant break from action in a movie that has kind of goofy montages throughout. This one's very to the point and very serious. And it amplifies the Cold War dynamics of the movie, the idea of America versus Russia. And it points towards the trajectory of the fight Rocky will have with Drago. It may seem like a cheap and blunt metaphor, but Stallone's script actually paints two opponents that are intrinsically tied to their respective countries. USA is the home of the hardworking, gritty, blue-collar workers, and Russia lives and breathes off its technology and science. And this dynamic is made painfully clear throughout the film's front half, and it escalates further with the montage. Rocky trains by running through the snow, pushing plows through the field, and lifting wheelbarrows full of people. And Drago is monitored by machines, pumped with supplements, essentially presented to the public as a machine. So, in turn, it makes sense that Rocky wouldn't win through sheer strength, but through hard work, endurance, bravery, and sheer will. The montage puts this plan into motion, while also accentuating the patriotic morals throughout the film. In terms of character, it displays a man who must persevere in the face of adversity and possible odds, and also must do the most American thing possible, get the job done.
That's very true. And it's interesting as well that type of dichotomy between hard work and science work allows, in the montage, because Rocky's living in Russia at the time, he's conquering the Russian landscape.
Exactly.
And so it's not just that he's beating Drago, he's actually beating the land of Russia by using it to train and make him tougher.
Yeah, and he takes it to the extreme when he gives a speech and effectively ends the Cold War all on his own.
Yeah, right?
It's very... Rocky IV actually kind of impressed me in that sense. It's very extreme. And it's really not afraid to shy away from the extreme patriotism going on constantly. Mm-mm. I don't think it's a very sophisticated way to present it, but I still admire the way he did it.
Yeah, and it's lived on and on and on.
Yep.
Cool. All right, I got me some La Aventura.
Nice.
Trying to put timestamps while we do this, and it's distracting. Okay, La Aventura. 1960, it's a Antonioni film. Starring his once wife, Monica Vitti. They were married, right? They're at least together.
I have no idea.
The first moments of the movie are Anna and Claudia, these two women, meeting Sandro to go on a trip. Anna's been seeing Sandro, but it's been a long time since they've been together. He was away on business. So they have a stilted but semi-nice conversation Anna and Sandra do while Claudia waits outside. And they're in a room that's sort of confined. We can see out the window at Claudia. And then we move to a boat. And we have Anna, Claudia, Sandro, and a bunch of their friends, like five of them.
Mm-hmm.
These people are all wealthy, they're white, they're happy, they're enjoying life. Then they pull up to an island. Sandro and Anna have a breakup talk, and Anna's breaking up with Sandro. And we could see leading up to this that Anna's sort of in a weird place. And after that conversation, she goes missing. The characters scour the island. There's very minimal conversation, and the time that we see them scouring the island looking for her takes minutes. And we just see shot maybe 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It could be up to 15, but we see shots of them wandering around up the rocky areas, like Claudia staring off, calling for Anna, Sandro walking, calling for Anna, the other friends sort of going. In that time, minimal conversation, a lot of distrust, a lot of confusion and anger, negative feelings, but also dedication, the fact that they continue to look for Anna. We can't forget the imagery here either. So the centerpiece moment is this on the rocky island while they're searching, because everyone was united, and now that she's gone missing, what we're seeing is everybody dissolving and dissolved. The rest of the movie is a reaction to the events on the rocky island. So those are the narrative reasons why it's a centerpiece, but visually the film moves from the small town to a boat to the rocky island to a mixture of civilization and nature. We go back and forth between the two. When you dig into this movie, you realize there's a connection between people and nature, that Antonioni is trying to say something about nature and civilization, which is why the background of the last shot, we see 50% mountain and 50% of the wall of a building. The moment on the island represents a kind of nadir, because it's not only the bleakest moment in the film in terms of what all these characters are feeling, but we also see the bleakest landscape in the entire movie. What's interesting, that during this nadir, we're also seeing these characters at their most human. It's when they're their most revealing about how they feel and care and how they react to this. So the centerpiece shows us how barren human beings can be, especially when alone in nature, how lost we can be in nature, and points us toward why we crave companionship.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's addressing why we build cities, why we live in proximity, why we seek love from people who may not be the best people, with Sandra cheating on Claudia after claiming to love her time and time again.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated by really long, sort of monotonous, silent shots like this, scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of, like, you know, Bellatar and R.J. Tarkovsky. And I always see people complaining about them. And instead of complaining, I think, why would they do something like this? And right. I try to attach meaning to it. Do you think maybe by just the simple fact that he's spending so much time in nature, and that's such a major theme of the movie, the more time he spends with them just circling through this rocky landscape that's actually building on that?
Very much so. Because you look at them trying to get answers when they're in this landscape, and they can't. There's nobody around. There's nothing around. They have questions, and they seek shelter even, and it's hard to find shelter. All the things they need in that time frame and all the things that they want are denied them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reinstilled by the fact that we spend so much time there. If we were just to have them going, Anna, Anna, for 10 seconds and then cut to them in the city to progress the plot along,
yeah,
we'd lose out on all of that.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I get it from a purely entertainment perspective that I don't necessarily want to watch 15 minutes of nothing. But from a filmmaking standpoint, I can't deny the fact that the longer that these filmmakers deepen these situations, the more pronounced that relationship becomes.
Yeah.
Very much. If they did it for 45 minutes, it it would be even more contentious, I would think.
Yeah, because it's obviously not a random thing that just happened to be in the movie.
Yeah.
It's a choice. Like, I'm going to show this for 45 minutes. Why?
Yeah, I'm a loser and kind of like shots like that. I'm always fascinated by them.
I love it. I feel like the longer a shot lasts, the more realistic the movie becomes in a way.
Yeah.
Because if you're just cut, you become aware of the artifice in a way to where when you actually linger on a shot, these people have to be in the moment more.
Yeah.
The actors and actresses, that is.
Yeah, Satan's Tango, one of Bellatar's most famous movies, features several scenes where people just walk down a long road. And you watch it for a couple minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time, I continually think of why the shot is lasting so long. And I can actually come up with reasons. I can see the how depressing like their situation is, and it kind of builds in that way.
Yeah. I mean, we see it in Weekend, too.
Yeah.
Such a good movie. Yeah, long shots. They rock.
Yeah.
Okay, part two?
Let's do it.
Okay. I had a brother. Aw. Okay, so this is a discussion on Pacific Rim.
You gonna play the song?
Oh, yeah. I'm so bad at this.
It's okay.
I really thought I had to speed up for that. Take a little trip, hey, to pack up your mind. Look forward, not behind, then see what you find. I called a sucker down, cause I thought it could rhyme. If it's mama, it's a call, a daughter must be a down. I gotta meet her. Don't take no shots, I don't use a reaper. Asian, I don't even play the radio neither. Only if I need to know the spokes or the weather. I'm a cool type of brother, but yep, your head, I sever from the neck. See, ain't now change, hit the stage. Set a date, sucker, in battle, we can't engage. I'll slice you, wipe you, marry you, divorce you. Throw the force you do, is what I'm forced to do. Put my back against the wall, cause it's bad, y'all. Okay. Did I let that go on a little long?
What, did you go get some yogurt while I was playing?
I just, it's been a while since I listened to the song. I was into it.
Okay. Well, Digliani loves yogurt for all the ladies out there.
It's just...
You ever want to get to his heart?
Give me yogurt now.
Different flavors, please.
Mostly if they involve chocolate or peanut butter.
Butter yogurt?
How good would that be?
You know what? I had a peanut butter popsicle.
What?
Yeah. And,
where?
And I ordered it. I went to Nashville, and I ordered it, and they're like, do you want us to dip it in chocolate? I was like, fuck yeah. Are you kidding me? I'll have a Reese's cup pop or whatever.
A Reese popsicle?
Reese popsicle. Reese's cup. Reese Cup Popsicle.
Reese Cupsicle?
Reese Pup Cup.
Pup Cup. Maybe I'll name my kid Pop Cup.
Please don't.
I'll consider not doing it.
That was also a nice transition for a movie that tries to unite the entire world.
What?
The song you played.
Oh, thank you. I was like, popsicles? They are good, but I don't know if anybody in the world likes them, if everybody. Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that.
Most of the connections we make are accidental.
Yeah. So centerpiece moment in Pacific Rim would be Mako's past.
Mm-hmm. The flashback moment.
Yeah, when they're trying to drift and Mako loses it and we go back and see... That little girl does a great job conveying terror and fear in that scene, yeah. By the way.
At one point, I got annoyed with her panting, but then I realized that was just good acting.
It was great acting. Like, how do you convince that girl that what's going on?
What if they just scared the shit out of her offset and then put her in the scene?
They had Idris Elba actually, like, running behind her. He's scary. He's an intense man.
I would pretend to be scared and then fall over like, ooh, what are you going to do?
Oh, I can't believe you took it there. Okay, so we get the flashback scene, and leading up to that, we didn't really know anything about Mako, but the moment we meet Mako and see her interaction with Stacker, we can tell that there's some sort of relationship there. And not necessarily romantic, but something. And that there's mystery surrounding the two, because Raleigh asked her if she wants to be a pilot. She's sort of hesitant about it. We know Stacker's reluctant to have them interact on that level. So we don't quite know why, and we're curious. Plus, Mako's slipping from the drift to begin with. We don't know why she's struggling.
Yeah. Well, he says at one point that he doesn't want her to join Raleigh because she's too, like, emotionally attached.
Right.
Which so is... we know that there's some sort of trauma associated with the... Oh, what are they called? Sorry.
Kaijus.
Kaijus.
Yeah. Yeah, that she's had her own sort of black past. Which then, by creating that mystery, you have to answer it at some point.
Yeah.
And this movie decides to use that as the centerpiece moment of the film.
Yeah, I mean, this is a moment where you see Del Toro shining through, because he chooses a moment that's very, it's a very psychological moment when they break away from the action, and you get this very elongated scene that is just a girl struggling with the fact that her family just died.
Yeah, and she's running alone through a city with a giant monster chasing her.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful shot, and it's almost like it's just got this dreamy sense about it, and the fact that Riley's there watching it.
Yeah, it's cool in the sense, too, because we've heard a lot about the drift leading up to this and how the minds are connected, but this is the first time that we've really gotten to experience it. It's the only time. We don't see anybody else interacting with anybody else's memories. So it's definitely a change. It's the most psychological moment of the film in terms of answering questions about backstory. I mean, maybe if they had kept the death of the brother a secret for a while and then went into that as backstory. But even this feels different. Like, the ages going from everybody as an adult back to Mako as a child dealing with this is a change in tone. We don't see a kid really threatened at any other point.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's alone says something else completely.
Yeah, and that even, the fact that she's alone allows the fact that she's so close with Stacker to, it allows that, it gives that relationship some real heart and, like, and it kind of points towards the fact that, if we're talking about what these centerpieces point towards, it points towards the fact that she and Stacker have a shared resolution they need to reach, the same obstacles to overcome. Stacker needs to learn to trust Mako, and Mako needs to understand where Stacker's coming from, and there needs to be, like, a joint resolution they reach.
Yeah, because there's obviously a conflict born from this moment in the sense that he's feeling very paternal, and she's wanting vengeance while also feeling very grateful to him. So how do they overcome what each of them want? Him to protect her and her to get revenge.
Yeah.
And we get that eventually. Raleigh presents that fix because he connects with Mako. It's also interesting, too, with the Stacker moment here, because we know that characters respect Stacker, or at least he has the demeanor of it throughout the movie, and we can tell that he's working hard. And we had the line with Mako where Raleigh tells her that they don't have to listen to him, and Mako says something about it's not a matter of, like, blah, 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 listening, it's about respect. And we get why in the centerpiece moment, in that flashback. But it's a cool thing that some movies do, a lot of animes do it, actually, is that you set up a situation in which we need a hero. Superhero movies do it a lot, too. But
yeah,
this is a situation where the little girl's alone, needs a hero, and here comes Stacker.
Yeah.
it also changes then how we feel about him, how we feel about Mako.
And if we're also talking about these centerpieces pointing towards character trajectories, I think it kind of misses out rounding out Mako's as a character by herself. Because this whole scene, it does set up the relationship between her and Stacker, but the fact that she's unable to drift sets up the idea that she needs to overcome her past in order to co-pilot with Raleigh. And they don't do it at all, actually. All of a sudden, she's in the robot ready to go, which was a really strange choice, I thought, because this is the most hyped-up moment of the film, the most out of place stylistically, and it was really setting up to be about Mako. And then it kind of just abandons her.
Yeah, it just says, oh, she's okay now. Like, somebody else knows about it. He can support her. It's okay.
Like, if Stacker had gone out into the field and then she had to go help him, that would have made way more sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because she would have had motivation then that's related to her mystery. There's also resonance with their past. Like, there's an inversion on what had happened before.
Yeah. Yeah, and while I like the centerpiece moment a lot, I do think it creates a lot of problems for the movie, because even you have Raleigh there trying to coach Mako through that moment, and there's another way they could solve that. He's the one that finally gets through to her and gets her to go out and do the job, and that doesn't happen either.
No,
there's so many relationships they could have built through that moment.
Right, they sit and have the conversation in front of the Jaeger, but that's not quite the same thing.
No. Yeah.
It's nice, but...
It's a nice little moment.
Yeah. This is the instance where the movie could have been a little longer and could have been a little better.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, sir, should we get into, if we were going to consult on this movie, what would we do different, or the...
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Anything else on the centerpiece?
No.
No, okay. So, if we were going to consult on this movie, that was one of the things... about the relationship. They could have built a stronger friendship between Mako and Raleigh.
Well, this conversation kind of stemmed, the idea of us consulting stemmed from the fact that I got in a mini argument with somebody on the internet again. And he was bashing the movie because Mako was sexually attracted to the big, strong man. And
he's saying that wasn't feminist enough?
I don't even know. That's a very strange feminist statement to say that women are no longer allowed to be sexually attracted to men in movies, especially when it has nothing to do with their character or their arc or them as a woman in any way, shape, or form. But at the same time, my friend Chris, we've been talking about this movie a lot. Me and Modigliani agreed that that is a problem. We could see, like, we don't agree with it, but we could see people making that connection and creating problems for the movie. So a way to fix that would be to build their friendship instead of building the romance. The romance is okay. She can be sexually attracted to him. He's a big, hot guy with huge muscles. Of course she is. Yes. But the movie ends with them, you know, touching foreheads. It's a very nice moment, and it's fantastic that they don't feel obligated. The filmmakers don't feel obligated to make it romantic. But if you're going to go for that, building the friendship and making it less romantic is probably the way to go.
Yeah, and you could have done that, especially with the drift. You set up the drift in the centerpiece as this very crucial moment to him understanding her, for us understanding her and Stacker, all of this. You could have had a few more scenes with them trying to drift and really going back and forth into each of their pasts. And you could even connect it with, like, Mako dealing with watching Stacker fighting Kaiju, going back to Raleigh and his brother fighting Kaiju. You could still have action moments that connected to the plot and made it entertaining. You wouldn't have to just go for straight exposition and boring stuff that slowed down the pace of the movie. But you could have shown more about their lives and them understanding each other by drifting and connecting that way. that would have allowed us to feel the relationship get deeper while also getting into this aspect of the movie that was so crucial, which is drifting.
Yeah, because drifting only really gets a psychological... I mean, the idea of that you're going inside someone else's memories is very... presents a lot of opportunities. And the only moment they really utilize that is during the Mako's moment.
Yeah, it's like if you were to have Inception, but you only have them go into a dream once.
Yeah.
You're missing out on the potential of the film. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was one of the things that we thought the film could do better. Could also see more characters interacting. This is an attempt to... The movie... Del Toro stated that he wanted to make a multicultural film, which is why it takes place all over the world. We see shots all over the world. You have a cast of people from different countries, and... But it feels very small, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they only go to China, and they're not going to China to create, you know, any sort of, like, unifier between USA and the rest of the world. They go there because that's where the plot takes them for convenience. That's where Charlie Day has to go to get the brain.
Right, it's right by the breach. Great.
And while they're there, they just show a bunch of poor Chinese people hiding out in a bunker.
Yeah, the one crucial person in the city that Charlie goes to see is a rich white man.
Yeah. For a movie that strives to be more multicultural, we even have those Russian pilots. It kind of half-asses it. People were definitely... I mean, to me, it's not a huge deal. You don't have to build a multicultural film. But in terms of consulting, if you're going to claim you want to make a multicultural film and then don't deliver, people are going to see that and get on your ass about it.
Yeah, because the more... I mean, even if they never claim to make a multicultural film, if they go to China and then just show poor Chinese people...
Yeah.
Like, something like Skyfall was multicultural without trying to be. It went to Shanghai, and we get to see some of Shanghai culture, but it doesn't come off as offensive. I feel like this movie comes off as a little offensive in that
way
of portraying.
Because it's not really trying to create an understanding of that idea. It's more of an exploitation of it.
Yeah, and a throwback to the fact that a lot of the giant creature movies take place in Asia.
Yeah. I know Del Toro loves Godzilla.
Yeah.
It might have been some misguided intentions there.
Yeah. So, and I feel like it, not giving the Chinese Jaeger pilots any dialogue whatsoever.
Yeah, that was very strange.
It was almost, I feel like Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire was a more multicultural film than this was. They at least utilize the wizards from the different schools better than what this movie did.
Yeah.
And then
I just like that you chose that movie.
Well, then to kill the other two, like the Russians and the Chinese, without letting them do anything interesting.
Yeah, they didn't even have a line, I don't think.
No, they don't get to kill a single Jaeger or Kaiju each. They just go out there and die immediately.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Not good.
No. Well, so then we get to more of the nitpicky kinds of, if that wasn't nitpicky already, but this is the big one for me, and it sort of ruins... I can still accept the movie for what it is, but this almost ruins the movie for me. Why didn't they go inland?
Yeah, because the Kaijus are attacking coastal cities, and they've already had the idea of building a wall.
Right.
Which is a great first step. Good job, guys.
Yeah.
Building the wall is a good idea, but you know what you can also do to put some distance between you and the monsters? Move away from the coast.
Move. They're all coming out of the water. We know this. The breach is underwater, so they all have to swim up. If you move inland, imagine being in Nebraska.
Yeah, there's plenty of room out there.
and you see a kaiju's coming off the shore at California, how much time would it take this giant monster to go from the California coast to Nebraska, where all the people are?
Not enough time for us to destroy it before it gets there.
Not enough time?
I phrased that wrong, probably.
Yeah.
I meant to say it wouldn't have enough time to get there before we killed it.
Yeah. I mean, you can just bombard the shit out of that thing between there and there.
You wouldn't even need the Jaegers if you didn't want to.
No, you could just put up a whole... You could just drop bombs on them from there. You could build a whole bunch of walls that just take them forever to get through.
Mm-hmm.
You could put landmines all over the place. You could do so many things. I just don't get it.
Yeah, and when we talk about plot holes, me and Mudigalani don't like plot holes, and we think it makes the narrative weaker. But a lot of people don't care about plot holes. And in the case of like something like Dark Knight Rises, where everybody was screaming about plot holes in that movie, there were also as many people screaming that it didn't matter. And if you're making The Dark Knight Rises, that's not a good thing. You don't want people just arguing over plot holes in your movie. You'd want them to focus on the movie more. So it actually is a good idea to fix these really little nitpicky things that are actually detrimental to the narrative.
Yeah, because people could, on first viewing, just say, oh, that was good. But I feel like subconsciously, even if they don't know why they don't think the movie's great, they don't think the movie's great. And yeah, it's because there's this logical fallacy going on.
Yeah. Another plot hole we thought of was when the kaiju does its little electricity move and it wipes out the electricity in the base. China's electricity seems to remain untouched, I guess. There's still like neon lights everywhere and there's lights in that bunker and nothing's affected.
I feel like we saw a shot too when the pulse went out of everything in the city going off as well.
Yeah, because they were by China.
Yeah, so it was weird to me that you see everything go out, and then everything's still on.
Yeah. And the only thing I could think of was they mentioned nuclear energy at some point, and it makes me think that maybe China was powered by nuclear energy. But if that's the case, then why is the base not powered by nuclear energy? Because if an entire city can be run by nuclear energy, why can't this base?
That's true. You would think at that point, too, with the dependency on electronics and them being able to build giant fucking robots, that they would find a way to counter EMPs. But maybe they don't think the kaijus have the ability to throw out an EMP. I wouldn't expect that.
This is a case of where something could make sense as opposed to the inland thing, which makes no sense.
Right.
But it's not explained at all.
Yeah, we just don't have enough information to really critique it. Like, we can't say, that's bad. Like, there could be a plausible explanation.
Yeah, exactly. Of course there could.
Yeah. Unlike nobody seeing Batman putting the oil up to make a giant flaming bat symbol. There were news coppers all around, police on the bridges. I know he's Batman, but come on. And he walked on the ice that everybody else is plunging into.
That one drove me nuts.
He has time to do arts and crafts. Okay. And the last thing, why didn't they use the sword the entire time?
I gotta admit, this was my favorite part of the movie.
The sword.
She just goes, she taps a button and a little thing on the screen comes up and says, sword.
Like, what?
It was like Power Rangers.
Yeah, that's cool, right?
And parts like this make me remember it's a kid's movie, but it's still not okay to just randomly throw that in.
No, like, did they not have the sword to begin with?
Yeah, and it's tearing shit up.
Yeah, because if I had that sword, and I was Raleigh, in that first fight where my brother died, instead of, like, shooting the thing 20,000 times with the pulse cannon, I'd have been like, oh, I'm going to use the sword.
Well, I think, actually, they talked about how they improved...
They upgraded it?
Was talking about how they improved the Jaeger, and I think they added it. That's why she's the only one that knew about it.
Okay. Which still then begs the question, why not use it in the first fight?
Exactly. instead of allowing two of your Jaegers to die and just punching them over and over.
Yeah.
You could have just used the sword the whole time.
Yeah.
And how did she not tell Raleigh about the sword?
Yeah, by the way, there's a sword. We should use the sword.
There's a sword that'll defeat anything we face, by the way.
It just cuts right through it. Yeah, the sword, too. I thought some of the scenes in the final fight were cool, and they're using the sword a lot. It's just, the final fight was very anticlimactic to me.
Mm-hmm. I would even go as far to say that the fact that Raleigh didn't know about the sword kind of hinders their friendship.
Oh.
And they could have built some sort of even professional relationship where they discuss the new features. They just kind of have a line where, like, oh, it's better now. How is it better?
Yeah, that's true. And he drifted with her. He should know these things.
Well, that's true. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if the idea is they connect the two halves of the brain, wouldn't he automatically gain that knowledge?
He hinted a couple times that he already knew things because they drifted. So why wouldn't he know that? I feel like if you're going to share things, that's one of the things you would share.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, it's little things like that that bother me about this movie. I still think there's parts that are fucking awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And was very entertained by it, but in being a good movie, I would have given it that rating because of things like this.
Yeah, agreed.
Oh, and should I just start complaining?
Yeah, just go on a 10-minute rant now.
Alright, the fucking end with the bomb. The bomb! How many sci-fi movies with alien takeovers do we see end with the hero or heroes taking a bomb to the base and destroying the central command unit?
Mm-hmm.
We see it in Star Wars. That's a shot, but it's still the same idea. Independence Day, we have it. The movie Oblivion just did it, but at least they died with it. Sorry if I ruined the end. Cowboys and Aliens did it. The Watch does it. Tron Legacy does it. Alien vs. Predators did it. Attack the Block does it. Battle Los Angeles does it. Titan AE does it. It probably happens in some, like, cut footage from E.T. It's just very bothersome to me that filmmakers don't have anything better to do plot-wise than say, oh yeah, we're gonna take a bomb and just wipe everybody out. It's so simple and done. It's done. Stop it. Stop it.
Yeah, I never even really thought about how many movies actually do that.
A lot. That's one of the reasons.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's one of the reasons I respected District 9 was because it tried to do something different with a sci-fi plot.
Yeah, sure.
Hmm.
Yeah, we were talking about District 9 earlier.
Yeah.
And whether or not Elysium is going to be good.
Yeah. I wonder if they're just going to tie them together.
Yeah, maybe he could pull off the film universe scenario.
I'm still waiting for somebody to do that.
Because as much as I enjoy the Quentin Tarantino and Pixar theories, they're probably not true.
It's to the same sort of degree. I wonder if the Tarantino one is true.
Maybe.
Maybe. But
for
yeah.
A guy who makes so many references in his movies.
You could see him, yeah. It's just, I'm waiting for somebody to try to do that. Like, these all take place, or even like a group of filmmakers.
Yeah.
Like, they each come out with 5 films and do different things in each one, and then tie them all together somehow. Like, what if 7 and The Usual Suspects ended up being in the same universe?
Mm-hmm.
I would see the 3rd movie. Kaiser Sose tracking down Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt.
Nice.
Hell yeah. Well, the other thing that this movie made me think about was blockbusters are often all about denial, which sort of frustrates me.
Yeah, I diagnosed it as probably a product of expectations and your demographic and everything. It's very easy to do this, to just, that's why origin stories are so popular. Spider-Man had two origin stories within like 10 years of one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to just strip the protagonist of power and responsibility and deny them, you know, that status they had in previous movies and everything.
Yeah. So then you get the crowd feeling validated because by the end of the movie, they get what they've wanted because you've denied them wanting that thing the entire time, which is very frustrating. So like in this movie, we start off with Raleigh being able to pilot a Jaeger, and we go another, what, hour and a half before we get him doing anything with the Jaeger again.
Yeah.
And it keeps teasing us. It keeps denying us. Like, the other guys are out there, and they're Jaegers doing things, and Raleigh and Mako have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I get it. I get why they do it, because the crowd's, like, waiting. We're going, like, yeah, send them out there. We want them to go in and save the day. But at the same time, fuck you. I'm tired of it. Like, we see it in Star Trek. They spend the entire first movie building up to the Enterprise crew that we all know and love. So you're denying people of that, which is what they want. And then at the start of the second movie, you break apart the crew right at the beginning, which means, again, you're denying exactly the thing people want and building up to it again. Spider-Man 2, you have Spider-Man giving up being Spider-Man. Batman, or Dark Knight Returns, or Dark Knight Rises, you have Bruce Wayne stopping being Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Transformers, they will go forever without there being a battle until the very end. And it's very annoying, because all you want is a good plot that mixes with these things. X-Men 3, mm-hmm. they get rid of their mutant powers. In the new Wolverine movie, Wolverine doesn't want to be Wolverine.
Yeah. And then he has to get it back.
Yeah. So bothersome to me.
Yeah. It's another one of those things, kind of like the ending with the bomb. Things we don't really acknowledge on a conscious level. And we just kind of accept that movies do this without really criticizing it.
Yeah, I'm here to criticize.
I'm glad you're here for that.
Yeah, thank you.
I actually used to, like, not care about plot holes and stuff, and then Modigliani turned me.
Here I am. I'm glad to be of service. So, anything else on Pacific Rim?
No, we teared that shit up.
Yeah, we did. Actually, we did. Literally. Sorry, Pacific Rim. So, top movies for 2013?
Yeah.
So far?
We're going to do this instead of... We used to do weekly power rankings, and we realized how useless that was.
Because we do monthly power rankings for what we've seen.
So we'll just do top tens for the year, and we'll see how that changes each week.
Yep.
I'll just go through a quick top ten. Number 10 is Upstream Color. Number 9 is The Lords of Salem. Number 8 is Leviathan. 7 is Barbarian Sound Studio. Number 6 is The Last Stand. Yes, you heard that right. Number 5 is Before Midnight. Number 4 is Caesar Must Die. Number 3 is Lawrence Anyways. 2 is Stories We Tell. And number 1, still undefeated, Spring Breakers.
Nice. All right, my list is awful. I haven't been to...
You haven't really updated it, have you?
No, but I haven't been able to see that many. With moving and selling a house and cleaning out a house, I haven't been able to see a lot of the movies of 2013, and I haven't... There's no art house out in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
So the movies I've seen, eek. So number 10, I guess, we have The Purge. Yeah, that's where we're at. Number 9 is Warm Bodies. Number 8 is Iron Man 3. Number 4 is Beautiful Creatures.
Whoa, you just jumped from 8 to 4.
Yeah, number 7 is Beautiful Creatures. What else did we see?
I've seen Pacific Rim, The Heat.
Oh, yeah, okay. Number 6 is 42. Then number five is...
This Is the End is in there, too.
Yeah, This Is the End. Number four... Or no, maybe number five is Evil Dead. And number three is Man of Steel.
It's fascinating to watch you do it on the spot.
Yeah, this is all on the spot. Number four is Man of Steel. Number three is Pacific Rim. Number two is This Is the End. And number one's The Heat.
Nice.
That's awful.
It's not awful. I like The Heat.
I mean, I like The Heat, but it should be my number one for 2013. I will say that I've seen The Spectacular Now, which comes out August 2nd. I saw that at Sundance, and that'll be my number one.
That counts.
Okay, so that's number one.
Why not? Yeah. Did you like Man of Steel?
I liked parts of it enough.
I got that you appreciated moments of it, but from what I got from your last section, you didn't really care for it.
No, I don't overall. There's things about it that make me very angry. Like the fact that it destroys a ton of Metropolis and then nobody cares. Like, it doesn't address it at all.
Yeah.
It just shows Clark at work and everybody's like, oh, great, Clark's at the Daily Planet. Never mind, just millions of people died. I think there's a really awful fight, but I like the arc of Clark Kent in the movie and of Superman. I think Superman's really well done in the movie.
Yeah.
But all the stuff on Krypton was dumb to me. I like the neck snapping, too. Like, that it builds up to the neck snapping. I give it... It earns a lot of respect points. Yeah. There's a way better movie in there than what was made.
Yeah. Like, that's the story of Zack Snyder's life.
Yeah. Poor guy. Ugh, that was painful to me. Okay.
You just have a week where you watch 2013 movies.
That's gonna be... Oh, that sounds so good. I want to change that list so much. Okay, are we done with part two?
Yeah.
Alright. That means we're at part three. Everybody I Love Dies. Hey, I know I'm a bad ass. You mean city, pretty, know I'm shining down. Riding with a couple of land bras, and I'm trying to dog. Hey, you know how we ball. Right in this shiny claw. Walking design them all. Hey, in the 90s, y'all. You know about me, dog. Don't talk about me, dog. And if you doubt me, dog, you better out me, dog. Don't throw no slightly, bro. Don't want to fight me, bro. There we go.
The song that launched a career.
Yeah, that was it. He's gotten so much better.
Yeah, I've never really listened to him.
Yeah, he's gotten more dynamic.
T.I. is who we're talking about.
Yeah, right? T.I. T.I., T.I., T.I. Not to be confused with Magnum T.I.
No.
I guess that's P.I.
It's P.I. I thought Magnum T.I. was a rapper I didn't know.
Do you think people ever call him Magnum T.I. and he's like, don't fucking call me that?
It'd be like if you called Mark Wahlberg Marky Mark.
He'd probably get really mad.
He does.
Does he?
He hates it when people call Marky Mark.
Yeah, I guess that's like seeing somebody that went to high school with and them still calling you, like, piss pants. Because you peed your pants
Chris,
once.
Or, Madigalani, was your nickname in high school piss pants?
No. Yes. Yes. Actually, it was number two pants. So, questions. The first question, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah. Who would win in a fight, Jack Black from School of Rock or the Predator? I like this question because... The Jack Black from School of Rock exists in a world where Predator has already come out. So if he's seen Predator, he knows covering himself in mud is a really great advantage.
I never even thought about it that deeply.
Yeah.
Wow. And he knows that he can be unarmed.
Now, beyond the mud thing, I don't know how much of a shot he has.
No. I'm going to go with Predator.
Predator, in most cases, is going to win.
Yeah, I think if we ran a simulation, like, 999 times out of 1,000, Predator wins.
Yeah, agreed.
Or maybe Jack Black plays music, and that's the Predator's weakness. It just falls right to sleep.
My uncle took the liberty of answering this question, and he said Jack Black wouldn't win because he can't carry a movie.
That's harsh. He did great work in The Holiday.
Yeah. You like that movie, don't you?
Sort of. I saw it when I, what, like summer of 2006? So
it's one of the movies I rated one star.
Yeah, I think I remember it being charming.
Yeah. It mostly pissed me off.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to rewatch it.
No. Okay. I will say he's really good in Bernie, although I didn't like that movie at all.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. He's really fucking annoying in High Fidelity.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. I love that movie, so I probably just like him in it.
I love High Fidelity, but he bothers me a lot.
Yeah. Huh. I think the next question's for you.
Why did Maleficent hate Sleeping Beauty and her family so much?
Yeah, because I don't remember this movie.
It's really... I mean, it gets blown out of proportion a lot.
Yeah.
But what happened was Sleeping Beauty's family invited Maleficent over for dinner.
Uh-huh.
And they told her to cook something.
Yeah.
So Maleficent made a pheasant and brought it over. And Sleeping Beauty took some, cut off a little bite, took the bite, and then discreetly brought up her napkin and spit the pheasant into her napkin.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And
that's not cool.
Right. And Maleficent, she'd been taking cooking classes, and she was self-conscious. She knew she wasn't a good cook, but she had put in a lot of time and effort and really hated that somebody would throw it in her face like that. Even though Sleeping Beauty thought she'd be polite, that's where it first started. But what really escalated things was Sleeping Beauty had a friend over, and they didn't have an extra bed. So they went over to Maleficent's house and asked if she had an air mattress they could use, and Maleficent did, and they put a hole in the air mattress.
Yeah. I think I remember reading that.
Yeah, yeah, it's, I think it's in the extras.
Yeah, it's weird for a movie to have that amount of exposition and it not be a factor at all in the movie.
Yeah, you would think they'd put it in, but they really cut it just to keep the pace going.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, you don't have time to dwell on trivialities like that.
No, and if you're getting into the domestic realm like that, it really takes away from the fantasy.
Yeah.
I think Disney wanted to convey.
Yeah, I mean, air mattresses associated with Sleeping Beauty, it's a little ridiculous.
Ah, who could picture that?
Nobody, that's why they cut it out.
Yeah, but that's the true story.
Yep, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Okay, recommendations.
We got two recommendations now. This is the first time we've had two at the same time.
Yeah.
Moving on up.
Moving on up.
The first one is National Treasure, which we will begrudgingly watch the next couple days. And the next one is a movie I think we both like a lot, which is Kung Fu Hustle.
I like Kung Fu Hustle.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite movies, like, in high school.
Nice. It'll be good to watch it again, especially because watching Shaolin Soccer was sort of disappointing.
Yeah.
So
a lot of great pop culture references in Kung Fu Hustle.
Well, we should see how many we can find.
Yeah, but what I'm going to watch for this time is if they're empty or not. I know they're goofy, but I don't know why there are so many references in the movie, like if it means anything.
Maybe it's getting into the Buddhist feeling that everything's connected.
Whoa, you just blew my mind.
There you go.
The Buddhist palm is the movie uses.
Final Attack?
Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
People in the apartment above me are running.
Yeah, I've been in that apartment complex and that happens.
I don't get it. They're loud.
Yeah.
All right, list off. For no reason, best book adaptations.
Yeah, this was a pretty simple one. There are a lot of movies that are based off books.
Yeah, it was... I mean, it was easy to find ones, and there's been a lot of good ones. So, these probably would make your list as well.
Yeah, they were all pretty much runner-ups for me.
Oh, really?
All of yours were runner-ups to mine.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah. And I meant your list as the listener. For you listeners. Do we have listeners?
Sorry. When you say you, like me?
Should I just say Remy? You probably have these on your list. Okay. So do you want to go first? Should I go first?
Go.
All right. So no particular order, not like a 5-4-3-2-1 thing or 1 through 5, but Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which, as everybody knows, is based on Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. Yep, common knowledge. I'm going to go with Pacific Rim, so it's relevant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's based on a famous Asian erotic novel.
Yeah. Do you know what the name of that novel is?
Pacific Rim.
Oh. I just got that.
Oh, boy.
Okay. My next one's Taxi Driver, which is based on Cold War in the Event of a Bomb procedure pamphlets, like the ones that show kids ducking, hiding under their desks in case a bomb's dropped.
Yeah, we all know that's how Scorsese put his stamp in Hollywood.
Yeah, really.
I think making such a bold choice in an adaptation.
It's crazy, because you wonder how he got inspired to make that film, then you get that as the story behind it, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. All comes together clean. I'm going to also go with another movie discussed, Rocky IV, which was, it was based on two things, but, you know, Stallone, he's a smart guy, he combined them. It was based both on the Communist Manifesto and the goddamn Declaration of Independence.
I never even thought about it, and now that you mention it, I see it perfectly.
Yeah.
He did such a good job of weaving the themes of both through the movie.
And then it culminates in that fight.
It's impressive.
It really is.
Alright, so my next one's Chronicles of Riddick, which is based on the autobiography of Jimmy Carter, An Hour Before Daylight, Memoirs of a Rural Boyhood.
That is a perfect name for a Jimmy Carter book.
Right? And, I mean,
dead on.
You can tell that Vin Diesel took a little bit of a liberty with it.
Yeah.
It's way more cosmopolitan than A Rural Boyhood, but you can see sort of maybe Pitch Black as the rural boyhood part, but Chronicles of Riddick, definitely An Hour Before Daylight, suits him with his eyes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My next one is Argo, which I loved. Argo is actually based on a napkin that Ben Affleck and Chris Terrio wrote on while vaguely remembering the events of the real-life scenario.
Mm.
They just kind of scribbled on a napkin how they think the event might have gone and what sort of liberties they could take with it and what they could exploit, you know. And they just kind of went from there.
And they published that napkin as a Kindle book, right?
Yeah.
As a self-published Kindle book.
Yeah, in addition to winning Best Picture, they sold, like I don't know, 6 billion ebooks of that or something.
It's crazy. It's only 99 cents, and it's so good.
Yeah.
It just, it's amazing how Ben Affleck writes how he speaks, so you really just hear him in your head as you're reading that napkin.
Yeah.
Hmm. Great work.
Good job, guys.
My next one's Little Big League, which is based on Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. It's one of the greatest economic books of all time, right?
Sure.
Economists from the time that it was written in, what was it, like 1812? Wealth of Nations. Sorry, I don't know the print date of Wealth of Nations off the top of my head. So indulge me here a little. As Wikipedia comes up, it was first published in 1776. So from that time, it was a seminal work, and people continue to read it to this day. And we really see it exemplified in Little Big League, as a struggling small market team looks at how it can perform better against competition with more money, a larger fan base, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's impressive with what it does.
Yeah, at first I was confused why my professor put it on in my economics class.
Yeah, Little Big League?
Together to me.
He didn't explain it well, then, the connection.
He didn't explain it at all. He's like, this is what we're watching.
Oh, yeah, it's all about...
I was like, I've seen this movie, and but in the context of being in the economics classroom, it all really came together for me.
It's all about resources. Mm-hmm. How you utilize your resources.
Oh. Next one is Legends of the Guardian, The Owls of Ga'Hoole, which is based on Zack Snyder's childhood diary. So it is literally a recreation of saying Zack Snyder did as a kid.
I never knew that either.
Yeah.
Do you just... I need to start watching the extras.
Yeah, The Sucker Punch was actually the first movie he did that's not based on anything.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah, I think he needs to go back to it. I think there's more pages in there he could...
Yeah, right. He probably could have combined his childhood from Guardians of... Or Owls.
Legends of the Guardian.
I'm going to stop. Okay, my movie, the last one that's the best book adaptation, is Spider-Man 3, which is based on the book Everyone Poops. Fuck You. Which is directed at Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi.
And my last one is Mud, which if you know me personally, or have ever heard me talk about it, you know I love this movie to death. Mud is actually based on a wastebasket full of crumpled pieces up of paper with horrible ideas written on them, and then barfed into.
That's what... Oh.
Yeah. That's like the big, gimmick for this movie. That's what they're selling, trying to get it like the Oscar bait.
Yeah, that's impressive that they took those materials and were able to adapt something that was so true to the source material.
I think they took the soggy, barf-ridden papers out one by one and threw them against the wall, you know, because it's going to stick so well.
Yeah.
And the arrangement it came up in was kind of how they thought the story should go.
Oh, wow. That's bold.
Yeah. It. Not everyone is that committed to writing a completely shitty movie.
No, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
Go them.
Yeah, good job, guys.
Well, so that brings us to awards.
Yep. Best original screenplay.
Yeah. Okay, so good change of pace.
Yeah, since we've been talking about all these movies that are based on books.
Yeah. All right, so mine is Gone with the Wind.
Obviously.
Yeah, if there's any better best original screenplay, point it out.
Let us know.
Yeah, there's not. Gone with the Wind.
Since Madigan had already taken Gone with the Wind, I was kind of at a loss because I wanted to pick The Shining, I wanted to pick Clockwork Orange, I wanted to pick 2001, Space Odyssey, but basically I'm just going to go with Stanley Kubrick's entire filmography.
Such an original thinker.
He is. He never read a book in his entire life, so that kind of made it easier for him.
Well, it's even more impressive that he didn't even know how to read.
Yeah, because he seems like a smart guy.
Oh, very well spoken. Eloquent. If you listen to interviews of him, he speaks in the way poets dream.
That's crazy.
Yeah, the man was a master of the tongue. He just couldn't read worth shit.
Yep. What was up with that?
Could it read worth a lick? Oh, boy. Is it possible for Stanley Kubrick to haunt us?
If it is, it's going to happen.
That would sort of be great.
Yeah, actually, if I could have anyone haunting me, that's not a bad one.
Unless he took the form of a little kid that whispered Red Rum.
Yeah. Well, maybe he'll pull a Paranormal Activity 3 and just, like, watch movies with us.
Oh, that'd be so good. Like our own Toby?
Yeah.
We have him on... We should just include him on the podcast from now on. Like, Mo, Mort, and the Ghost of Stanley Kubrick.
That's happening, by the way.
Yeah. Tune in next time.
Alright, I think it's time to roll the credits.
We're on to more shit, yeah.
Yeah. This is the blooper section.
Yeah. This is where we don't get serious.
As opposed to the last 20 minutes of this podcast.
Yeah.
So, things, our favorite things from the weekend. My number one is I had a pear and goat cheese pizza paired with a pineapple margarita.
I'm so jealous of this.
and that shit was awesome. It even had salt on the rim of the margarita, and it was fantastic.
It sounds so good. Where were you at?
Just a local bar.
Mm.
And I'd only ate lunch when I went to eat that pizza, and it was like 8:30 at night when I got to eat it.
So it really felt like a victory.
Yeah, I inhaled it.
Mm,
jealous. I just shoved it into my face and absorbed it.
Did you even use your mouth at all?
Nope.
That's...
I needed fuel.
You are a talent. It's no wonder why you've lived 140 years.
Mm. You too.
Yeah, well, I don't know what I do that's so special.
Yeah, definitely not.
It's probably the long baths I take every day. Okay, so one of my top things from the weekend was watching YouTube videos of Craig Ferguson. Oh, my life. You know, when you say things like that, it really puts your life into perspective.
I'll also just throw one of mine in really quick that I didn't write down. I watched YouTube videos of ducklings this weekend.
Sounds so much sweeter and nice.
Yeah, you've talked about Craig Ferguson before.
Yeah, I love Craig Ferguson. His
yet to watch him.
If you go to YouTube, he has a cult following on YouTube. And he just has so many good interviews because they're not the same sort of desperate attempts at question and answer and communication. He just doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, that's one thing I like Jimmy Fallon a lot because he's changed up the talk show format.
Mm-hmm.
But he basically, you know, goes down on every celebrity that's there.
Yeah.
And he just, like, lushes over them and kind of asks them those sort of starstruck questions.
Well, and if you talk about, you look at Jay Leno and David Letterman as sort of the old school way of doing things and sort of dry at this point.
Yeah.
You look at Jimmy Kimmel as just, he's the ginger ale of talk show hosts. And then you have Jimmy Fallon. It's sort of like he's doing a lot of new things, but Craig Ferguson just breaks it all apart. He's French New Wave.
Yeah.
Or I guess it would be Scottish New Wave. But it's so good.
Awesome.
And he's had a breakthrough. They're now giving him A-list celebrities. He had Morgan Freeman on last month, Sandra Bullock on. She's been on before, but...
Is that not the case before?
Before, he was getting a lot of the B-list people.
Okay.
Or, like, TV show people were coming on a lot, but not the big names.
Yeah.
And now he's starting to get big names.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. Seth Rogen was just on Jonah Hill.
Cool. After I had my pear and goat cheese pizza paired with a pineapple margarita, I went and saw a burlesque show for my first time.
Yeah, titty tassels.
Yeah. It went exactly how I thought it was going to go.
How's that?
Slowly ripping off clothing and then pasties.
Pasties.
My favorite part of the show was there was a guy that was in the troupe. And he came out and he found a box of pornos and he started looking through them. He was doing it like Charlie Chaplin style, so it was like kind of creepy. And he's like giggling over them. Then he finds a beefcake porno. And he gets super excited, rips off his clothes all in one tug, and he's wearing a thong. And then he sits down in a chair, turns away from the audience, starts to masturbate, and then confetti flies everywhere.
Wow.
When he, you know, when finishes.
Yeah. That's impressive.
It was show-stopping. Everybody went apeshit.
They really went for, that's one hell of a burlesque show.
Yeah, it was cool. And it was a local one, too.
Man.
Yeah, Champaign is a pretty cool town.
That's, with that name, you would imagine that things would be a little more...
sophisticated?
And drunken.
It is.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Did he have, like, a... Did he have a dick pasty?
No. He just thought.
No dick tassel?
Nah.
I feel like a dick tassel would just be hilarious.
You twirl it around.
like, imagining a penis right now is not, like, the happiest thought for me, but with the little dick tassel, it's just so funny.
It could be, like, frayed on the end and, like, it looked like it's shooting stuff out. You could, like, put it next to a fan and it could, like, rise up and, like, flow in it.
You put little clackers at the end?
Yeah. Oh,
so,
yeah.
So as it's spinning, it's just, like, clack, 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 clack.
And you could make your balls each glow a different color.
Holy. I think we've just started a burlesque show.
You're doing that, right?
Yeah, yeah. Do we have any sponsors? Can't we get a sponsor? Jeez. Okay, so I went grocery shopping. That was another highlight of my weekend.
I will say that I like grocery shopping. I like going by myself and spending a lot of time in a grocery store.
I like the yogurt section.
You really do?
No, that was a joke. But there's some good yogurt.
Yeah, well, there's lots of flavors of yogurt.
This grocery store has a great health food section. So it's been interesting just to sort of, like, go and look at all the healthy foods that I've been missing out on, which turns out to be most of my life. So it's been good.
Cool. I watched Comedy Bang Bang for the first time this weekend, and it's really funny. Do you know about that show?
No.
It was a podcast, and basically it was a podcast where celebrities just came on, and you interviewed them, and you played games.
Okay.
The show, it's on Netflix, is a scripted talk show, and they just do wacky shit the whole time, and it's really funny. They've had on, like, Seth Rogen and Amy Poehler, Adam Scott, Michael Cera, John Hamm.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really funny.
So the only thing we're really missing are those people coming on our show.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Because this is all scripted.
Yeah. Obviously.
Yeah, we talked about dick tassels months ago.
Yeah, I remember I wrote down dick tassels July 15th.
Keep in mind.
Yeah, just remember that for the July 15th, because I'm going to go see a burlesque show a few days before that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oracles.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished the Roberto Bolaño short story collection, Insufferable Gaucho, and that was good. I love Roberto Bolaño. He makes me very happy.
Nice. What's that book about?
Oh, there's 5 short stories and 2 essays.
Okay.
And Bolaño is just, he's fascinating to me. Because we talk about show don't tell a lot, but he tells and tells and tells and tells. In a way that his telling is showing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a strange style. But one of the stories is about a rat police detective. So at first you think that the guy might just actually be a police officer and these are all people. And there's little details that you're like, wait, they're living in sewers? Like, what's going on? Wait, why'd he carry the guy in his mouth? And then you realize that these characters that have been through the short story are actually just rats. And they have a very human-like society with, like, schools and hospitals and police officers. And cool. There's a murder mystery going on.
My other thing was I celebrated Israel Day this weekend.
Ah. L'chaim.
What?
L'chaim.
My friend likes to make up holidays. And celebrate them.
Oh.
Which is funner than celebrating real holidays.
So I'm Jewish and didn't know this wasn't a real thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's okay.
Ooh. Okay.
Irish and I don't know the Irish holidays.
St. Paddy's?
Yeah, there's gotta be more than that.
Saturday?
In Ireland.
Saturday night? Friday night?
But anyway, Israel Day happened because a few years ago, this guy got drunk with this random guy he didn't know and, like, his friends, and they all got so drunk that they started taping their beer bottles to the ceiling. Wow. And it was during the time that Ken Jennings was going on his streak on Jeopardy. So while they were taping Beer Bowl Ceiling, they were watching this guy, and the final Jeopardy answer was Israel. So they decided every year on July 12th, I think, that they would celebrate Israel Day.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm sure Ken Jennings would like to hear about that.
He'd probably like to go.
Yeah, they should invite him to celebrate with them.
Because he's kind of being forgotten at this point.
Yeah, he really needs to pick it up. Go, Ken. Go, Ken. Go. Go to Mort's friends. You can do it. All right. I have terrible cell phone signal in my apartment. So I was trying to figure out what to do about that. And when you get signal boosters, they're all like $200. So I called AT&T, and they have something called a microcell. And they give you, it's like connects to your internet and gives you a cell phone tower in your apartment or in your house. So you get really great signal. But again, it's $200.
Uh-huh.
So I called today, and sometimes I really feel like I have the force. And it's like light side force where I wave my hand and people do what I want. Mm-hmm. Except listen to the show. I keep waving my hand and asking people to listen to the show. And
yeah, we can't get the sponsors either.
No. Sponsors. Sponsor us. But so I turned the charm on, and I got the microcell for free.
Nice.
Yeah. I didn't even have to be demanding. Did it have to, like, make threats? Did it have to say, I've been a customer forever? I just talked good conversation, and which is surprising that I could have a good conversation, but got it for free.
Good job, bro.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks.
Killing it.
Thanks. It's good to have your support. No, you're in my corner. My corner.
Don't put baby in the corner.
Uh-uh. Anything else?
No. I want to go to bed.
Yeah, so next time we have National Treasure.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Tune in for that.
You thought Rocky IV was American.
Yeah, wait till you see National. Oh, yeah, it's very American. It's actually a great point. Okay. So Clips is going to play us out?
Yeah. You want to shout out your Twitter handle?
Oh, yeah, my Twitter handle. It's @Modig_Liani.
And I am @Mort_Granville.
And we have a website, which makes no sense when connected to our podcast name. Podcast name. And it's modigmovie.com.
Yeah.
And you can find us on Facebook. Modigmovie. Like facebook.com/modigmovie.
Just search Modigliani.
Movie inquiries.
Yeah.
Or Modigliani. Just search.
It'll pop up.
Search in life. We're easier to find than Carmen Sandiego. So that's it?
Yeah.
We're done? All right.
Lace out. I got two wheels, plus wheels. Pulling up in the grill, I'm so chill. The girl on Cosmos, Chris Steele. And she pulling around for the wheels. Bitch, I'm trail. You don't give me though. Bitch, I'm so trail.
Wait, I'd like to point out that the top comment for this song on YouTube says 1:06, signifying that at the 1:06 mark that something significant happens in this song.
Yeah.
And 30 people have liked this comment. I'm just going to skip ahead so you can, so the listening public can hear. Go on to the next, knock this in the decks of the Cali low lows. Houston, Kenny Payne, screwed up vocals. New York, Rain Rose, sit on Momo. Feature in that Bentley, GTO, no. Flow chameleon, worth by the million. Sell Bolivia. Anybody hear anything special?
Nope. What's going on?
Is it because he says GTO, no?
Just really clever wordplay, especially clever wordplay.
Yeah. Okay, keep playing us out. In feds in oblivion, bitch Brazilian, first reptilian, took her from far off island like Gilligan. Two wheels, plus wheels, pulling up in the grill, I'm so chill.
feel the good one, Cosmos, Chris Steele, and she's feeling around with the feels.